From historic Seminary Ridge in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, this is The Seminary Explores. Conversations about people, politics, theology, and life with your host, Dr. Gerald Christensen.
Talking about Christmas and all of its joys means that we should look back once in a while to its origins in the New Testament. Our guest today is the Reverend Dr. Mark Vitalis Hoffman, who is professor of biblical studies at Gettysburg Seminary, and we're glad to welcome him to our podcast on the subject of the New Testament in Christmas in the New Testament. Mark, the first thing that strikes me about Christmas is that while it is a major celebration in the Western world, in Japan, maybe elsewhere, it's actually only reported in two Gospels out of the four. What does that tell us?
Well, first of all, the earliest Gospel, of course, we have is the Gospel of Mark, and Mark is one of those that doesn't include it. And partly I suspect that shows us that for the Gospel of Mark, at least, he was less interested in sort of metaphysical questions of nature and the identity that way.
Where did he come from and all those things.
Yeah, he deals with them in a variety of ways. But for the Gospel of Mark, clearly his focus is on the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus, that what Jesus ended up doing that way is of much more significance than trying to figure out where and how he was born. Mm-hmm. So it's Matthew and Luke, then, that we turn to for our Christmas stories, and they have some points of agreement, but even there's some variety, but both of the variety that they have is their way of trying to highlight particular emphases on what they want Christians to know about Jesus and who he was.
Let's start with Matthew's probably a little bit earlier. In any case, it's the first gospel as in our current edition. So let's start with Matthew. What's his particular take on the incarnation?
Well, it's interesting when Matthew, he sort of tells us where he's going, even from the very first verses when he starts out in Matthew 1, because he's going to trace the genealogy, and he's going to trace it back, identifying Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. So he's going to trace it back in these three sets of generations of 14 each, and all of those things are ways that he ties this in closely to Israelite history. So Jesus as the Messiah traces him back to the Davidic line, and tracing back to Abraham, really the first Jew, the first with the covenant of circumcision. Mm-hmm. And so here with the genealogy, he embeds him into Israelite history. And even in doing that, he has those interesting women that he that shows up in that genealogy that prepares us for understanding that there is some irregularities here that are going to happen with Mary, and that we shouldn't be surprised when that comes about. And then when Matthew tells his story, Joseph is the key character. It's the angel appears to Joseph, and we have this interesting promise in Matthew that he's going to be called Jesus, Yeshua, to save his people from their sins. That's drawing on that background, the Hebrew root on saving, and also that he should be called Emmanuel, which is that term for God with us. Yep. And, you know, I like to point out, whenever is Jesus called Emmanuel in the Gospel of Matthew? Never again.
Not ever that, right.
Until the very end in the Great Commission, at the very end of Matthew, where Jesus promises, "And lo, I am with you always," so where that promise of Emmanuel is realized.
You come back to the beginning. It's a planned gospel in that sense, isn't it? He knows
correct.
What he's doing. What's the emphasis then in Luke?
Well, Luke is interesting because he'll start out, first of all, in Jerusalem. And there's a sort of geographical concern that we have Zechariah, the father of John the Baptist, in Jerusalem, serving in the temple. Mm-hmm. And that's where the first annunciation occurs regarding the birth of John the Baptist. And the reason why that's going to become important is because we're going to see a motion a movement within the Gospel of Luke. We start in Jerusalem in the temple, and then we're going to find Jesus' ministry in the north in Galilee. Then in 947, you have this turn to Jerusalem, where everything finally at the end of Luke culminates in Jerusalem with the crucifixion and the resurrection. And the last thing that we hear in the Gospel of Luke is the disciples are supposed to stay there, mm-hmm. and we find them in the temple worshiping. Mm-hmm. So there's a bookmarking, mm-hmm. focusing on the temple that will then start in again in the book of Acts, where we're in Jerusalem, yes. and it's from there that we move to the ends of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
So there's two movements going on there. For one, then, is one focus on Jerusalem that embeds this story again in Israelite history and all of that whole first chapter,
yes.
with Mary's song, the Magnificat, and Zechariah's song after John the Baptist is born. They're just thoroughly Jewish sort of praise, thoroughly using Jewish traditional language that way. And it isn't until chapter 2 that you sort of, you get that, the famous Christmas narrative,
yeah,
that
right.
we always have there, when those days, yeah. the decrees went forth, yeah. from Caesar Augustus.
We shifted there, haven't we? We shifted from a Jewish or an Old Testament setting to a Roman setting because we got Caesar Augustus coming there all of a sudden.
And exactly. And so with that shift right there, we can see how much Luke is interested then not just embedding, setting Jesus within his Jewish context, but also within the Roman Empire. And we're going to see that then throughout the book of Acts, mm-hmm. Luke and Acts, mm-hmm. where, for one, the attention to Gentiles is mm-hmm. going to be coming out. And then, of course, in Acts, where
the mission begins
in Rome,
yeah,
and,
yeah,
and the mission extends that way. So Luke is where Matthew is maybe trying to really focus on Jesus as the Messiah, the Jewish Messiah. Luke, on the other hand, is very aware of that, but even in his genealogy, he goes back through David, through Abraham, and keeps on going all the way back to Adam so that yeah. Jesus becomes yeah. the Son of God in a larger sense for all people.
Correcting the fall of Adam and Eve in the process. We've mentioned two Gospels having the story, and the reason why Mark does not. What about the fourth Gospel, John?
Well, John is another interesting thing. And when you look at John, you can see he's aware that there are issues going on about where Jesus is from, is one of the big questions that constantly comes up. Where is he from, and is he from the proper place? And in John, that question is, the answer to that question where Jesus is from is not Nazareth, it's not Bethlehem, it's he's from God.
Yeah.
So
in
you've,
the beginning was the Word.
In the beginning was the Word. So you've moved to a much more cosmic scale, and so the significance, certainly again a Jewish gospel, certainly aware of the Greeks, as he calls them, that are interested in discovering more about Jesus. But this becomes then sort of a much more universal gospel that reflects sort of a Christian community's longtime reflection on who Jesus was and how this all relates to God had been working through all of Israelite history.
To put it a bit of a humorous twist on it, you can figure if you count them up that it's John the Baptist 2-1 over the birth of Jesus. Four of the Gospels all talk about John the Baptist. They're all very important at the beginning. Only two have the story. Now, you've explained why and what the circumstances indicate that, in fact, there's more to that than the simple counting. But nevertheless, this John the Baptist thing is really very important at the time, isn't it? That seems to have been a beginning and maybe also a controversial point.
Exactly. The controversial in terms of the speculation that John raised regarding his own identity. And we see that especially being worked out in the Gospel of John, where he's mm-hmm. very adamant and explicit that he's not the Messiah, but he's pointing to the Messiah to come. And all of the Gospels work with that. But we clearly was an ongoing issue, and we see in Acts and Ephesus mm-hmm. that there are still disciples of John the Baptist mm-hmm. at this point who have to come to learn more mm-hmm. about Jesus as the Christ.
So the movement was significant enough, and was either close enough or different enough from early, the incipient Christianity that it had to be addressed.
It had to be addressed, and Mark does that in another way. If you read in that first chapter of Mark there, Jesus certainly seems to be something of a disciple of John the Baptist in terms of continuing his message, but he's also seen as a successor because it's when John the Baptist gets arrested and subsequently will be beheaded, but it's there that Jesus then emerges and takes us all in a new direction.
Let me give you just certain things that we all remember about the Christmas story, and you can identify where they come from and comment on them. Let me just start with the manger scene. Should we imagine that as a farm scene?
There's a couple things going on there. Luke, where it talks about there's no room for them. And the word that's used there tends to refer to sort of a guest space in a house. And we would have to imagine that if you're doing traveling in that time and went to some community, the first place you would go would be to stay with relatives. It's not likely that you would be looking for the Motel 6 or whatever, but staying with relatives. And the point there seems to be that there wasn't room for them with the relatives. And this connection with the manger, that's really, and there's archaeological exhibits that we have there, is more like a feeding trough than oftentimes made out of stone, sometimes out of wood. And so we're picturing maybe he's downstairs with the animals rather than upstairs with the family that this is taking place. The Gospels don't mention anything about animals at the birth, but that manger word is what brings them in and suggests that this was in
a... It's not as comfortable as a manger even, right? I mean, if we're talking about a stone feeding trough, that's not your typical accommodations when you come to Gettysburg for the 4th of July, even if it is full. That's a little rougher than one imagines even today. Let me pick out another one. Shepherds and angels.
Okay, now there, again, we're in Luke. And what's partly really interesting about Luke at this point is that who are these witnesses to Jesus? You've got Mary, so you've got this woman, and now you've got shepherds. These are not people that were regarded as legitimate witnesses even in Jewish society. What you would really want are some well-established men to be witnesses of the birth. So there's something here that you have shepherds being witnesses that's already looking at this sort of appeal that Jesus is making to those who are imprisoned and those who are suffering and oppressed and loosing those binds. Shepherds is that they become the first evangelists as they witness the birth and then go and tell afterwards is a striking commentary about how Christianity understands itself, appealing to all people.
The Gospel of John that says, but Luke that gives witness to this idea of come and see and go and tell, the centripetal and the centrifugal. Angels.
So the angels, again, now we've got angels who are providing information to Joseph in Matthew, being warned in these sort of dreams here. And we've got the angels in Luke that have the Annunciation to Zechariah, the Annunciation announcement to Mary as well. And then Luke also has the angels making their announcement to the shepherds in the field. So... as a reader reading this, angels are recognizable and reliable authorities and witnesses. So they become a way that validates this account within the story for the readers.
They're from headquarters. And only when you get into the baptism where you hear a voice, even then it's a voice in some instead of, you know, it sounds like the voice in Asia, but from the heavens and where God... It speaks even more directly that the testimony, the witness that this is my son. Magi. They're not kings.
They'd be wise men, and probably more likely astrologers than anything else. In the
not
terms
like you
of,
and me as the wise professors of Near Eastern
maybe,
studies.
They could be, except they had gold, frankincense, and myrrh.
Yeah, sorry,
we
did not
have that.
Okay. I'm sorry for the interruption, astrologers.
But they would have been understood as people who inspected the heavens, and not in the way that we understand astrology today, but... And there's all sorts of speculation about what this was that they saw exactly. Was it a comet or perhaps more likely some conjunction of planets and stars or something that brought them to Jerusalem, associating this heavenly conjunction with the house of Judah and with a royal sort of function here. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, they were wise men, but as we see them when they show up to in Herod's court, here's where you wonder how wise they are when they go to King Herod and said, where's the king?
Where's your rival? We want to go and worship your rival.
but that allows for the story to move forward and to have this recognition then already from the very beginning that this is, again, a sort of larger cosmic phenomenon as we see John is going to take that even another step farther. It's beyond the stars even then for John.
Yeah, that's really good. Which reminds me, is there any historical evidence outside of the New Testament of a slaughter of innocents by Herod? Do we have any written record of that? I mean, the story is important. I'm not trying to put that down, but I just wonder if there's any corroborating.
There's nothing that we have that would indicate that. It's interesting, I mean, partly that they kill the children up to 2-3 years of age there, which would sort of indicate some span of time that's happened in there. So we have no direct evidence of that, but on the other hand, it wouldn't surprise anybody.
No, when you think about who's involved and what happens nowadays with some dictators, yes.
Herod the Great, he killed off a number of his own sons, and he felt they were threatening him.
Very good.
It wouldn't be a surprise.
I've got one more before we ask about the significance of the whole story, and that's a delicate one. May I call it the legal status of Jesus, the boy Jesus? What do we know from the New Testament about his parentage?
Well, you have to count, if you're going to push a virgin birth in some way, then it meaning that you're discounting the paternal aspect of things. Now, Matthew sort of picks that up. I mean, that's where Joseph plays a prominent role, and this is all tried to be explained.
It's a matter of faith,
then,
for Joseph.
For faith for Joseph. Mm-hmm. But we get a hint that there was certainly scandal involved with this, especially in the Gospel of Mark.
Yeah.
He doesn't have the birth story, but when Jesus goes back to his hometown, to Nazareth, they talk about him as being, isn't this the carpenter, and isn't his mother called Mary? Now, what's so distinctive about that is everybody else would have been identified as the son of something, son of the father, rather than as
Jesus
the son
ben
of the
Joseph.
Mother.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of a scandalous sort of thing that's just being hinted at there in that point. So it remains an ambiguous issue, and we see the different ways that the church has tried to, that the gospel authors have tried to. Negotiate that clearly an unusual birth.
Yeah, well, so I know you're a historian of the Gospels, and I know that means that there may be some authenticity to this after all, because the scandalous parts you would not expect a normal historical reporter to put into certain kinds of books where they're trying to propose something really important like this. So when it shows up, you say, hey, we got to pay attention to that.
Right.
The main significance, what are the gospel writers trying to say about Christmas? Who is this Jesus from the story itself or in its context?
Right. On the one hand, we can start with Mark. And as mentioned earlier, he's not so much interested in the ontological issues of the essence and the beingness of Jesus that way. For Mark, Jesus' presence among us all leads towards the crucifixion and his resurrection, that Jesus as the crucified one is really the important thing for Mark. With both Matthew and Luke, we see that he's very concerned, that they're concerned for one, on the one hand, to tie Jesus closely into the hopes and the dreams of all the years of all of the Jewish nation, of all those messianic speculations that Jesus fulfills those things. And both Matthew and Luke clearly highlight that. Luke expands on that then as well and says this is not simply a Jewish, the realization of Jewish dreams and desires. This is also the hopes and fears of all the years of all the people. Mm-hmm. And so moving into that Gentile aspect of saying this is for everyone, and then moving beyond that even one more step to John, mm-hmm. who sees this as really the sort of culmination of all of creation that's coming through here, that from the very beginning, this has been the way God has been planning, that now comes to realization mm-hmm. in Christ, that's going to now change the rest of the scope of history.
Going to change the universe as well as humankind within it. They're all going to be pointed in the same direction because of Christmas, the incarnation. Dr. Mark Vitalis Hoffman is our guest today. He's professor of biblical studies at Gettysburg Seminary. We've been talking about where it all began. For the Seminary Explorers, I'm Jerry Christensen. Have a very good day.
You've been listening to The Seminary Explorers from historic Seminary Ridge in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, a production of the Lutheran Theological Seminary at Gettysburg. We invite you to visit our website at www.ltsg.edu. All opinions expressed on this program are those of the individual speakers and are not necessarily those of Gettysburg Seminary or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.